This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carol Van Dam, and here's what's coming up.
I've always made the book, and what the leadership doesn't think I fit into the criteria they want, you know, because I am looked at like somebody who cannot be them.
That is Rugyatou Nene Touré, an activist and politician on Sierra Leone's moves to increase women's participation in politics. Also, gunmen killed 10 people and injured 2 in Cameroon's troubled northwest. And Russia has suspended its participation in the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which is likely to hit Africa hard. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Sierra Leone's new parliament will have the largest female representation in the country's history, with 41 women lawmakers, more than double that of the last election. Activists say that number could have been higher had a new law that reserves 30% of leadership roles for women been followed correctly. Sananu Tord reports from Port Loko, Sierra Leone.
Rugyatou Nene Touré entered politics in 2007, mainly to advocate against female genital mutilation. After one term on a local council, she says her political party refused to give her another seat on 3 different occasions. In one election for 2 council seats, she says she won the second highest number of votes, but her party put a man in the seat after the election.
I've always made the vote, and what the leadership doesn't think I fit into the criteria they want, you know, because I am not act like somebody who cannot be them, you know, and somebody they consider to say, she not just accept things, you know.
Female activists in Sierra Leone say that kind of manipulation is keeping the number of women in office down, even after President Julius Maada Bio in January signed a Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment Act, or GEWI, which requires that women hold 30% of all publicly elected seats and government leadership roles. Before the most recent elections, Sierra Leone's parliament had just 12% female representation, well below the global average of 26.4%, as struck by the Interparliamentary Union's Women in Parliament Index. In the government cabinet, only 4 of 32 cabinet positions were held by women, also far below the global average. GEWI aimed to change that. Marcella Samba Sisse is the executive director for Campaign for Good Governance in Sierra Leone. She says the law stemmed from Sierra Leone's 11-year civil war, which ended in 2002.
This was born out of the fact that a Truth and Reconciliation Commission report after the war noted that whole groups were excluded from mainstream politics and they do not know how decisions were made. And part of those groups were marginalized entities such as women and young people.
Since the implementation of GEWI this year, female lawmakers were voted into 41 of 135 parliamentary seats, more than double the number in the last parliament. Advocates have applauded the success of the bill so far, but say it is being applied unevenly. Under Sierra Leone's election system, voters cast ballots for a party, not an individual. Parties then fill the seats they've won from a ranked list of party members. Nikki Spencer-Coker, a lawyer and women's activist, says many parties place women in lower rankings, making them less likely to win seats.
Future advocacy should involve, you know, more work directly with the political parties to ensure that the women, that they're placing women in higher up on these lists, and that they're also placing them in safe seats, not in the seats that perhaps they're going to end up, you know, losing.
If the law had been followed properly, activists say there would be even more women in parliament. They also have concerns over parliament's leadership, as only one of the 14 parliamentary chiefs is female. Sierra Leone's Ministry of Gender told VOA in an interview that it will work to correct all the lapses in following the law, and together with the new female lawmakers, will push for more protection for female politicians. Sena Anutot for VOA News, Port Loko, Sierra Leone.
A short time ago today, Morocco said Israel recognizes its sovereignty over the disputed Western Sahara. Morocco's royal palace said Israel's position was expressed in a letter to King Mohammed VI from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Israeli news media says the Israeli government has not commented, but confirmed its officials met with Moroccan officials. Morocco annexed the Western Sahara, a former Spanish colony, back in 1975. The indigenous Sahrawi people, led by the Polisario Front, disputed that annexation, which led to a 16-year insurgency. The United Nations brokered a truce in 1991 with the promise of a referendum on independence, which has yet to happen. Russia today suspended its participation in what's called the Black Sea Grain Initiative. It allowed Ukrainian grain to be shipped to Africa, Asia, and the Middle East unimpeded by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. At the United Nations in New York this morning, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield harshly criticized Russia for the move.
This is really another act of cruelty. According to the World Food Program, more than 345 million people are suffering from high levels of food insecurity. And we know without a shadow of doubt that Russia's brutal war against Ukraine has pushed millions and millions more people to the brink, especially in the Middle East and Africa. That's what made the Black Sea Grain Initiative, brokered by the UN and Turkey, such a beacon of hope.
And Thomas Greenfield went on to say that Russia has thrown all this progress and all of this hope to the wind. And among those who will suffer are children in the Horn of Africa who are severely malnourished. To find out more about how this will impact Africa in the near term, I spoke to Harry Verhoeven, international economist at the Columbia University and senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy.
Well, it's a complex question, Carol, because as you know, some of the figures and some of the actual flows to do with the grain deal are heavily disputed. Russia itself argues that actually this grain deal was not nearly as advantageous to countries in Africa and the Middle East suffering from food insecurity, and argues, of course, that a significant amount, perhaps even more than half of this amount, was actually flowing to developed countries, to countries in Europe and elsewhere, and that the effects on global food prices, and particularly food prices within African and Middle East countries, were mixed at best.
Is that statement true, what you just said?
Yes and no. I mean, it's certainly true that there's a number of local and regional drivers of food prices, for example, in places like Egypt or Ethiopia, where I'm at the moment, or in Kenya, that arguably have a bigger impact than whether this food is actually forthcoming from Ukraine, yes or no. So, for example, the plummeting value of the currency, which has partly to do also with the indebtedness of some of these African countries, is arguably a bigger factor at this moment in time than the flow of food grains from Ukraine. Now, this is not to say, of course, that the fact that Ukraine has been able to make available millions of tons of food did not have a positive effect. I mean, it is true, for example, that in the last couple of months, food prices at a global level have come down. And at least part of that explanation for that is the greater availability of grains coming from Ukraine. So, you know, even if the effects are indirect, they're still welcome from the perspective, I think, of many developing countries that are indeed facing these pressures. Even if, as I said, there are other determinants of this to do with the value of currency, the distortion in local markets, security dynamics, of course, in many of these countries, including a place like Sudan, for example, or Ethiopia or Somalia. So it's a complex story, and Russia's decision is not going to help, even if it is true that it would have been important to revise some of that deal to better target it towards developing countries and making sure that some of these grains were indeed not going to Spain or to Italy or other Western countries instead of the countries where really it ought to be heading.
With this severe drought here in the United States, for at least a large part of the country, the grain harvest is also way down, the lowest it's been in decades, especially in Kansas and Nebraska, two big wheat producers here. How much will that play a role in affecting the price of grain and food commodities being shipped to Africa?
I think significant. I mean, the heat wave we're seeing across the Northern Hemisphere, right, in the United States, in Europe, also key parts of Asia, don't forget, which are also very important for global food prices, are all going to have effects in the next 6 to 9 months, as is, of course, the growing onset of El Nino, again, particularly on I'm thinking here of the Horn of Africa and Southern Africa, where we already have chronic food deficits, and this is really unlikely to help local food production, which again, as I said, has already been disrupted by political conflicts, by a number of, I think, fairly bad economic policies in a number of these countries. So yeah, we're really looking at another set of shocks on the back, of course, of what happened with COVID, on the back indeed of these kind of protracted climatic changes, which are not helping in any shape or form, either with food production or, very importantly, with the purchasing power of ordinary people.
That is Harry Verhoeven. He's a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy. He was speaking to me earlier today from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Cameroon officials say gunmen killed 10 people and injured 2 people at a busy junction in the city of Bamenda in Cameroon's troubled northwest. A witness told Reuters news agency that the attackers arrived in vehicles late yesterday. The gunmen ordered people onto the ground with accusations that they had failed to back local separatists, then opened fire as some obeyed while others ran. The Ambazonia Defense Forces, the main separatist group in the English-speaking region, denied responsibility. A spokesman for the ADF suggested that it could have been a revenge killing by another group. The governor of the Northwest region told Reuters a manhunt had been launched for those behind the killings and that investigations are underway. More than 6,000 people have been killed in Cameroon's English-speaking regions since conflict broke out in 2017 after protests for greater autonomy for the mostly Francophone nation were violently suppressed. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, check out voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Citing insufficient evidence from prosecutors, a Kenyan court today acquitted a self-styled preacher who claimed he could help infertile couples conceive so-called miracle babies throughout prayer. Gilbert Idea, a former stonemason who moved to London from Kenya in the mid-1990s, was accused of stealing 5 children between 1999 and 2004 to buttress his claims. He and his wife claimed their prayers could see infertile and postmenopausal women become pregnant in 4 months and without sexual relations. Prosecutors said the miracle babies were stolen mainly from Nairobi's poor neighborhoods. According to the French news agency AFP, senior principal magistrate Robeson Endieke found the 86-year-old not guilty. He ruled that the prosecution had not produced enough evidence to link Deya to the charges. Africa is facing a very tough year, from conflict in Sudan and the Sahel to droughts, floods, and other extreme weather events. But in a recent interview with VOA, the head of the African Development Bank, Akinwumi Adesina, is focusing on the continent's promise and how to better harness its rich environmental and human capital. Lisa Bryant has the story for VOA from Paris.
African Development Bank President Akinwumi Adesina is looking at Africa's bottom line, but not the one used by number crunchers that looks at the value of a country's goods and services.
The way in which we measure wealth may in fact have driven many of these nature-rich countries into a higher level of debt and poverty traps.
Instead, he's pushing for another accounting method, looking at the massive natural wealth of African countries like those in the forest-rich Congo Basin, which helps absorb climate emissions, among other positive nature-based solutions.
Gabon, DRC, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Angola. If you look at all of these countries that are in the Congo Basin area in particular, rich biodiversity, carbon sink, the largest carbon sink in the world. They get nothing for that. I've been pushing now that we need to revalue the wealth of the countries based on their natural capital.
Adesina spoke with VOA after a recent Paris summit intended to raise and rethink financing so poorer nations can tackle development and climate change. While activists say more must be done, observers say it delivered some concrete results, including a deal to restructure Zambia's $6.3 billion debt, $4 billion of which is owed to China.
I think that is good progress. It's slow, painful progress. I think we should be much faster. Creditors, time doesn't matter really so much for them, but the debtor countries can't. They need solutions now.
The West accuses China especially of pushing African countries into so-called debt traps for political or economic gain, something Beijing denies. Adesina didn't comment on that, but said China, which holds 14% of Africa's debt, must be part of other future debt solutions.
They are open to participating in collectively solving this problem for other countries. I will expect that they will have to do that anyway, given the amount of exposure that those countries have to them.
Rich nations in Paris also agreed to move $100 billion held by the International Monetary Fund into a climate and poverty fund for low-income countries. Adesina and others have been pushing for the money, part of so-called special drawing rights, or SDRs, to be channeled through the African Development Bank and similar multilateral development banks.
Every dollar of SDR that comes to us becomes it's leveraged 3 to 4 times. So the leverage factor is very, very important. And the SDR donors lose nothing. And it comes at zero cost because we actually pay an interest rate for it.
Adesina also says natural resource-backed loans that tap Africa's rich trove of oil, gas, and minerals should be off the table completely. He calls them toxic, non-transparent debts that mortgage the future of African nations. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Tunisia and the European Union have signed a strategic partnership that includes combating human traffickers and tightening borders to reduce the flow of migrants leaving the North African nation for Europe. The deal was signed yesterday in Tunis and follows weeks of negotiations. Europe pledged $1.12 billion in aid to Tunisia to help its battered economy, rescue state finances, and cope with the migration crisis. Most funds are contingent on economic reforms. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said the bloc will allocate some $112 million to Tunisia to combat illegal migration. The deal also promotes macroeconomic stability, trade, green energy transition, and legal immigration. Thousands of undocumented African migrants have been flocking to Tunisia in recent months, seeking to make their way to Europe in traffickers' boats. The situation has created an unprecedented migration crisis for Tunisia. South Africa is set to host the BRICS summit next month, but it is not at all clear which leaders will be attending the August 22nd through August 21st meeting or if the venue will change. Last week, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said the meeting will be held in person, prompting questions about how the country would deal with the arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court for Russian President Vladimir Putin, who is wanted on war crimes charges. In the second and final part of our interview, Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, explains to me the background of the BRICS relationship.
The term BRICS itself is relatively new. It was coined actually by an American banker to describe emerging economies which collectively would influence the 21st century. Brazil, China, Russia, India, South Africa. But the common interests of that group, there are some, but there are also divergences. Two of the BRICS countries are regularly at loggerheads and in conflict, China and India. So there are similarities, but there are also differences. And the question is really, do they have enough coherence to stick together as a group, or are there significant enough differences that as a collective, it's relatively meaningless, except as a club of people who aren't in other clubs.
Well, yeah. I mean, isn't it kind of a counteroffensive to NATO and other, you know, Western-aligned groups?
Well, that's where the BRICS break up. Certainly, South Africa, China, and Russia engage in military exercises together. Most recently, unfortunately, on the anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But India was not part of that, and Brazil stayed out of it. And as I mentioned earlier, India and China are regularly in conflict on their own borders. So there are differences among them. And so at the end of the day, the cohesiveness of the entire entity is questionable, although certain subsets, certainly the ties between China and Russia are very, very strong. And South Africa seems to be wanting to align itself with that.
Just one last question, and it's not really about BRICS, but as you know, recently a delegation from Africa led by the South African president tried to be the peacemakers with Ukraine and Russia and visited with both leaders on their turf. What, if anything, came of that?
In many respects, that visit, which was led by the really pushed by the South Africans, probably was one that they probably would have been better off not having. Not only was it shambolic, the plane accompanying the president, Ramaphosa, was stopped in Poland and not allowed to go on because of the number of military personnel and weapons on board. You had the president's spokesman denying that there were Russian attacks on Kiev, although everyone else heard them at the time. So in many respects, it rather than being even-handed and playing peacemakers, it provided a very transparent fig leaf to damage control that South Africa was trying to do in the wake of the Lady R affair and other instances where it seemed to be less than neutral.
That is Ambassador J. Peter Pham. He's a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of several articles on African affairs. He was speaking to me here in Washington. World number 6, Ans Jabeur, lost in the Wimbledon women's final Saturday, beaten by unseeded Markéta Vondrousová of the Czech Republic. A year ago, Jabeur also lost in the Wimbledon finals, and she lost last year in the finals at the U.S. Open. After the match, a tearful Jabeur said she thought it was the most painful loss of her entire career, but she promised to come back and win at Wimbledon. At home in Tunisia, where Jabeur is known as the Minister of Happiness, her fans were disappointed. This man says they would have liked to have seen a historic achievement by putting Tunis among Wimbledon champions. It wasn't meant to be, however. Still, he says Jabeur made history by playing in the Wimbledon final twice. Younger fans see her as a role model. 10-year-old Emma Bardaghisa, playing at the Tunis Tennis Club, is among them. Emma says when she sees Ans, she dreams of becoming better than her or just like her and reaching the Grand Slam final. Jabeur was hoping to become the first African and Arab woman to win at Wimbledon. And that wraps it up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, please visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nikki Peters, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM stations.